Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and John McWhorter is back with us today, the always thought-provoking, often contrarian linguist and political commentator. We'll talk about the Donald Sterling tapes, the Supreme Court's latest affirmative action restriction, which he supports, the use of commas, which he doesn't so much, and his new book, The Language Hoax, Why the World Looks the Same in Any Language. Hi, John. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. I didn't know we were going to do the commas.
Well, maybe we'll do the commas short later. Then we'll do the semicolons and the ellipses.
And the dashes.
And we invite bilingual callers and multilingual callers to engage with John McWhorter in this first part of the conversation. Does the world look the same to you in both or all of your languages? 212-433-WNYC. So the book is called The Language Hoax. What's the hoax?
Well, the hoax is that we're often told by very well-intentioned people that it's the structure of our languages, the way that it allocates words to things and concepts in the world, the way that its grammar works, the sorts of things that you have to hurt yourself learning if you're over a certain age, that those things affect the way you think. And it's not that anybody says that those things absolutely channel the way you think, but it's said that the difference in, say, the grammatical constructions of English and Chinese means that somebody who speaks one of those languages sees the world differently than someone else. Now, of course, to be a Chinese person is to see the world differently because of Chinese culture. But the claim from many linguists and psychologists is that the language itself channels your thought in that way probabilistically. And I think that it doesn't hold up and it's dangerous.
So, for example, to take an example that people have probably heard of, the fact that the Inuit people have many words for snow doesn't mean they perceive the world differently just because they have many words for snow. They happen to live in a place where snow is more of a presence in their lives than it is here in New York, and so they have many words for snow. Same thing with the fact that in Russian, there is no one word for blue. Examples you give.
Mm-hmm. Those are two different cases, and I'm glad you brought them up. And so, for example, the Inuit, they have many words for snow. It's not hundreds, but there's evidence that it is more words for snow than we have. Now, many of us would say, well, of course, because, well, they've got snow in their shoes. They live in snow. Of course they're going to have more words for it. But some people would say, well, isn't it interesting that their language has so many words for snow and therefore it makes them think of it more? And that doesn't quite work. We understand that that doesn't make sense. But then you think about Russian. In Russian, you can't just say blue. They have a word for dark blue and they have a word for light blue. Now, that is interesting. That's cool. But then you hear from some people that that means that a Russian-speaking person sees blue differently than Brian, you, or I do. And this is something that's very quick, but it's very important. Experiments can show that a Russian person is an eensy, weensy, weensy, tiny bit quicker than you or I at perceiving where dark blue goes off into light blue. They're very interesting experiments. But the question is whether we call that sort of thing a worldview.
So if it's not the case that the world looks different in different languages, are you arguing that this is politically constructed for political purposes?
It is. And I think that it's politically attractive, or I'd say socioculturally attractive, for really good reasons in themselves. To think, for example, that a language spoken by a small indigenous group of people, and let's face it, for most people like that in this world today, the history has been unpleasant. We train ourselves to think that if we understand that their language gives them a fascinatingly different view of the world than us, then that's a way for us to indicate to ourselves and I think to other people that we understand that all human beings have the same dignity, all human beings are cognitively equal. That's great. But the problem is that if you really go for this point of view that the way your language works affects the way you think, then you end up with as much mess as you do good things. And I thought it was time for somebody who was halfway credentialed to just make that case. That's what this book is about.
So they're trying to celebrate linguistic diversity to celebrate diversity and to battle the growing hegemony of English around the world?
Exactly. And I think that's a very important thing in its way. And I've argued against the hegemony of English in other ways. But you can't look at these grammars, these vocabularies as lenses on life in the way that we're often told. So, for example, just to take Chinese very quickly. In Chinese, in most aspects of the way it works, you have to say less than you do in English. To learn Chinese, I'm trying to teach myself some Chinese. A lot of the task after you're finished tackling the gorgeous but frustrating writing system is figuring out what you don't have to say in a sentence, plural, much less, indicating the past tense or the future tense, much less in terms of past, really not at all. Now, do we want to say that Chinese grammar channels you into thinking less about basically anything because it's a relatively telegraphic language? Nobody would want to say that. Well, then that means that we have to give up the idea that Russians are looking at Picasso paintings and seeing blue popping more. Neither thing works. We all see the world the same way.
But here's some pushback from the comments page to your article adapted from the book on New Republic.
Hmm.
One of the commenters said, in many languages, grammar specifies what something is made of. In Chinese and Japanese, for instance, you have to say a skinny of a pencil or a round of an apple and so on, writes this commentator. And mm-hmm. I don't even know if that's true, but it's mm-hmm. but it's on your article's comments page. So would that matter to your argument?
Nope, because that is very much true. And so you do have to say a round of an apple, a skinny of a pencil. I feel like I wrote that rather than the commenter. But the question is whether or not that constitutes a worldview, whether or not a Japanese person is walking around thinking of chopsticks as a substance rather than as a couple of things. And if you say, and as I said before, there are experiments that show that people who speak languages like that have a certain tiny, tiny sensitivity. But if we call it a worldview, then, for example, here's somewhere that one would want to go. Racists back in the late 60s and early 70s looked at black English, where you often say she my sister instead of she is my sister. Some of them were not racist. They were just well-intentioned people falling for this whole notion about language and thought. They thought that meant that black kids didn't process the notion of being in relationship in the way that you and I do. That's the sort of place you end up going.
Because they left out the verb to be.
Because they leave out the verb to be. So if you want to say that a Chinese or a Japanese person is walking around more sensitive to the roundness of things than us, then you also have to say that kids in Harlem don't understand being. Neither of those things seems to work to me because you can't have both.
Linguist John McWhorter, author of The Language Hoax, Why the World Looks the Same in Any Language. Bilingual listeners, multilingual listeners, what do you think? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Louisa in Washington Heights, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a bilingual person. I'm Brazilian. I moved to the U.S. when I was very young. And I agree that not necessarily two different languages give you a different worldview, but I think that they do expose some subtleties in each culture. And I think knowing different languages can help illustrate that. And an example I can give is the idea of age, right? And that's something I think is that in America, there's this obsession with age to the point where you ask somebody, how old are you? And in Portuguese, and I think in all Romance languages, you say, how many years do you have? There's an idea of ownership of your age and not how not young are you? And I think that those subtleties can be exposed, but that doesn't necessarily give me this broader view of the universe because I know more than one language since I'm a kid.
You know, Louisa, I know exactly what you mean. And I think that when it comes to something like that, I'm not sure whether we English speakers or those who speak Portuguese or even you necessarily are thinking in terms of a worldview on the level of years versus age, in that so much of a language is conventions where what the words actually mean and what we're thinking they mean are different. And I always use ice cream as an example. Really, that in our heads is this word that goes I scream. We don't really think of it as creamed ice. I'm not even sure how the term originated. It's this bizarre substance. It's really of itself. Ice cream, we say, and we know what it looks like on the page, but we really are thinking of something else. And so if you say, you know, what age have you? I'm not sure that the person in Romania and Portugal and Spain and South America and Italy is thinking of how many years you have as opposed to me or Brian who's saying how aged are you? I think there's a such thing as idiom that is quite different from what the words mean. However, I also say I didn't grow up speaking Brazilian Portuguese, and so maybe my intuition is wrong.
Louisa, thank you. Actually, another pushback comment on that New Republic page cites idioms in particular. This is posted by JAS11C, and it says, poetry and idioms. It's not about how many different words there are for snow or for subprime mortgage. It's about a French song that mentions une maison accrochée à ma mémoire, a house with its hooks in my memory. But you see, writes this person, it just doesn't translate as well.
I am not sure what that means. I know that there's poetry in many languages, but the point is, does French structure your thought in a certain way? And so, for example, if you think about it, those of you who are genuine French speakers, which I'm not, you can't say in French, the car is sticking out of that line. I parked it wrong, and you'll see the car sticking out over there. You can work your way around it, but there's no way to say, unfortunately, the way I parked the car, it is sticking out. You can say that in English. French doesn't happen to have that. That doesn't mean that a French person doesn't process that situation exactly the same way as we do.
Yvonne in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Hi, Yvonne.
Hi, Yvonne. Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm 66 now, but in my former lifetime, I was a language major, and I was fascinated by what I was interested in the time of psycholinguistics, and I was fascinated specifically with the fact every language I knew said, I am drowning, but I came across a Native American language, I don't remember which at this point, that said, the water is killing me. And it did seem to be a different, for lack of a better word, worldview.
Different
I am dominant, no matter what happens, I am central versus I am an equal and fighting something that is overpowering me.
A different relationship with nature?
Yes. A different relationship with nature, and I am always central no matter what's going on. I am.
All right. Thank you very much.
Those are always tempting ideas, and I know exactly what you mean. But once again, if you think of it that way, as opposed to an altered analysis, which is that there's an element of chance in what sorts of idioms and what sorts of structures a language maps onto particular concepts, then you wind up with odd ideas. And so, for example, I like hot dogs, one might say. And then in Spanish, you say that the hot dogs are pleasing to you. Now, does that mean that Spanish is making you think of some sort of agency on the part of the hot dog? Or if we're going to just be better about it, is really the hot dog the subject of the matter more than it is for me when I say that it's me who's doing the liking to the hot dogs? Too metaphysical, I think. And so a lot of these things are chance. Take something in English we don't think about. This is always more obvious when we think about it from English. I'm used to beef hot dogs. Used. I am used to. What does that mean? Now, we could write papers about why in English we talk about being used to something, but we don't. And I think it's because a lot of these things are accidents.
Another example brought up to me is that English has no masculine and feminine nouns.
Mm.
And so this person says when she thinks of things in Spanish, she has masculine and feminine images of things because of the way that language works, irrelevant as that may seem to English speakers.
You know, that is real. I mean, I find it really neat, and I always share this with my classes, that if you do a psychological experiment, you can show that people who speak languages with gender in that sense, if pressed, are more likely to see things that way. A French person is more likely to think of a table, la table, feminine, as speaking with a high voice than you or I are. That is very true. But once again, it just comes down to worldview. And if any of us know well somebody who speaks a Romance language in New York, that means anybody who speaks Spanish, are they walking around thinking of a table as something that doesn't shave and would be wearing a dress? And I don't think there's any indication of that.
I didn't ask you yet, by the way. I should have. If you speak more than English.
Mm-hmm. I can make my way with a confident poorness in a great many languages, but that is not good enough for the purposes of this, because we're talking about a language that is embedded right into your psychology in a way that native ability is required.
All right. So we'll hear one more example, and then we'll move on and turn the page and talk to John McWhorter about all kinds of other things, like in the news. Maybe you saw him on ABC this week on Sunday, and get into some of those affirmative action, maybe Donald Sterling. Maybe we'll get into some other linguistics with him, like his take on why it's okay to use like and totally.
Boy, this is everything.
And
wow.
We'll see. You write a lot of interesting stuff. So Stan in Jackson Heights. Hi.
The word butterfly in English, translated in Spanish, is mariposa. It's a lovely word. It rolls off your tongue. In French, it's papillon. You can almost feel the fluttering of the wings. In German, which is what I learned in Washington Heights growing up, the word is schmetterling. Mm-hmm. Now, you want to tell me that doesn't inform your worldview?
Yes.
You want to tell me it does?
Indeed, it does. The thing about German, the point I'd like to make, the reason German is considered the language of science is because of its precision, unlike French, which is vague. Vague is a French word. When Germans put together those block-long words, they're not only cataloging, you know, what they're seeing, but there's also a kind of synthesis of ideas, which is how you get Weltschmerz or how you get Schadenfreude. And I think that kind of synthesis in language does change your mindset.
Well, you know, to tell you the truth, I'm already in trouble for some things I wrote about French a few months ago, so I think I will try to kick back against that by saying that I'm not sure how French speakers would feel about the idea that their language is not precise or that they don't synthesize things. I would say that, I mean, there are all sorts of places we could go. I would say this, butterfly in English. Notice that probably now, for about the first time, we're thinking, what is butter about the fly? We might say something about how to speak English has something to do with thinking of a butterfly as some sort of Drosophila that's slippery or something like that. But we don't. We just say butterfly, and we have to kind of think about the fact that it's a buttered fly, and we wonder why anybody came up with that, but we don't really have time to think about it too much. That is the nature of this whole thing. A lot of how language works is much more based on chance than thought than we're often aware.
Could be the new thing at the chic New York restaurant after this conversation, buttered fly. John McWhorter, Columbia University linguistics professor, New Republic contributing editor, Time Magazine columnist, author now of The Language Hoax, Why the World Looks the Same in Any Language. We'll turn the page and talk with him about other things right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with linguist John McWhorter, commentator John McWhorter. And speaking of the Supreme Court, I saw you on ABC this week with George Stephanopoulos Sunday morning supporting the Supreme Court's latest restrictions on affirmative action, which is that voters in a referendum in any state may constitutionally bar the state university from using race as even one factor in building a diverse class. Now, for the record, I publicly opposed the decision here last week. Why do you support it?
Because I think that the nut of that one is a fear that the public is not sensitive enough to understand that race matters. And race does still continue to matter in the society for reasons that we saw rather graphically last week in other ways. But the question is whether race mattering means that affirmative action should, in 2014, still be based significantly on race as opposed to other things that matter. And so if you ask me, in the 60s, it made sense to think that race mattered to such an extent that you could think of being black or Latino as essentially just a stand-in for disadvantage. That made sense, I think, for about a generation. But I think after a certain amount of time passes, there are so many people who have benefited from exactly those policies that using race, because race matters, using race as a stand-in for disadvantage and having affirmative action be mainly about race, and let's face it, that's what we're usually really talking about, doesn't work anymore. Affirmative action, I think, is supposed to be about disadvantage. It's not that I don't think there should be any. Today, that's class more.
You don't think that race is still a very effective stand-in for disadvantage, especially when it comes to blacks in America?
When it comes to blacks in America in the specific realm of performing at a certain level in school in order to apply to a university? No, not in that sense. So there are all sorts of things we can talk about in terms of race mattering, such as the police, such as the war on drugs. These things are very real. But in terms of it's getting to be a cliche with me. I need to put a handle on it, but my daughter, which I now have, I picture in 16 years somebody saying, well, she's a color and therefore she's been disadvantaged when she's going to, you know, grow up in a rather affluent home with nothing that most of us would recognize as as disadvantaged. So, yeah, color matters. But now there are too many of my daughters. And so what we need to look at is the way someone came up and what they faced. And I think that now we can be brave enough to see that that means focusing on socioeconomics, which very quickly means black, poor, and lower middle class people, too. But not the me's. It's just time to let that go.
But that's all an argument about affirmative action and whether it's needed and what kind is needed. What I said here when the ruling came down was that the court had just turned affirmative action into a popularity contest among white people. And I don't think that's real democracy. Just about every state has a white majority. Certainly Michigan does, where the referendum was held that was in question. If affirmative action and other policies that might disadvantage or even resegregate blacks are up to a simplistic popular vote like that, then the Supreme Court has turned much of the fate of black America into a popularity contest among whites. Did they not on some level?
Well, you know what, Brian? Probably they did in the grand scheme of things. It's not that I can even pretend to say that public opinion about affirmative action can ever be as informed as we would like it to be. And yeah, there is an extent to which, and it's not a small extent, to which white resentment of affirmative action is often uninformed or insensitive. But there comes a point where we have to go back to at least the pretense of allowing these things to be placed with voters because, and this is something that people have argued other than me, as in I've never made the argument myself. I'm associating this with Cheryl Cashin, Georgetown law professor, black, who was on Stephanopoulos with me.
With you. She'll be on here next week, by the way.
That's right, because she's going to be in town. And before that, Carol Swain, who I think is a law professor at Vanderbilt, black female professor. The idea is that after a while, that resentment, which we're not going to be able to ever completely get rid of, starts to not be worth it. If you start policies that we started in the 60s, you knew there was going to be that. But the question is, how long do you keep it going? And I don't think that you keep it going until race doesn't matter, because I'm not sure race will ever not matter. It's a kind of – affirmative action is very necessary, but it's a kind of a – it's like chemotherapy. You don't want to overdo it. And I think we've reached the point where we need to reconsider it being based so much on race.
All right. Another issue. Clippers owner Donald Sterling banned for life from the NBA. For his racist rants surreptitiously caught on tape. Also fined the maximum of $2.5 million. That hasn't been debated as much. And the 30 NBA owners will vote on whether to force him to sell the team. Is the NBA commissioner Adam Silver doing the right thing, in your opinion, with these maximal punishments?
Overall, yes, although there is a question as to what should be done to somebody who thought of himself as saying something in private. But, you know, I mean, there are many things that one could say about Sterling. The one that seems to be particularly correct right now is that we're making all this noise about face-to-face, overt Archie Bunker kind of racism rather than addressing the institutional kind. But, of course, let's face it, it's easier because you can tweet about this. You can say things from the mountaintop about this. It's hard to sit in your living room and fight institutional racism. I also think about Sterling, though, frankly, and no insult intended to anybody, the man is quite old. If we're talking about the state of racism in the United States today, for me, the views of somebody whose childhood took place before TV or basically penicillin, I mean, let's face it, he won't be around that much longer. That's not America. But Brian, this is the main thing about Sterling. You know what we're going to hear in about 2 weeks from somebody for some reason, because you hear it all the time, it's that America doesn't want to talk about race, that we need to have a conversation about race. What have we been doing all week? I mean, I think America has a conversation about race all the time. The next time somebody says, well, America doesn't want to talk about race or is in denial about race, then we have to ask what with Sterling and Clive and Bundy and affirmative action all in that 1 week in late April of 2014, is this a country where we don't talk about race, please?
Is this a national unity moment then on race in your opinion? I'm waiting to see how opinion polls break down along racial lines about the punishment. Just about everything I've heard in sports media, which I've consumed a fair bit of over the last few days, and in general, you know, kind of general media, with the exception of a few conservative sites, has been, yeah, they had to do this for all the right reasons. Do you think this is a national unity moment, or are we going to see again when the opinion polls came out that whites and blacks and others really see the world differently?
Well, I could be wrong about this one, but this one is so obvious. I mean, his views were so repulsive. They're unreasoned. He's making them while he has a black or black-ish girlfriend. I mean, these are the easy sorts of things. Charles Blow telling us today in the Times it's almost too easy. The conversation on race is happening all the time. It's going to be messy. I don't think that we're ever going to be holding hands on a mountaintop and thinking the same thing. I think some people, when they say conversation, really mean conversion. And that's never going to happen because we're human beings. But I think that the conversation is moving in the kind of direction where most people who are giving it any thought think Donald Sterling is repulsive and that one might even bend the rules somewhat and condemn him despite the fact that he thought he was just mouthing off in his living room. That won't do what he was saying. So we are coming to a conclusion, but it's a messier process than I think many people are waiting for.
Listeners, we could sneak in a couple more calls here for John McWhorter on some of these things. If you want to call up, we're done with the world looking different in different languages, but any of the other things that we're getting into here, 212-433-9692. But back to linguistics. You made a case in an article recently for the much disparaged proliferation of the words totally and like, as
yeah.
in I totally like don't get what you mean by that. Can you make that case?
Yes. I think that those expressions, those words, are indicating a kind of civility in casual speech that we often just mistake for, you know, some sort of wad of bubblegum stuck under the desk because of who we associate those things with. But really, if you use like in that way, what you're doing is acknowledging that you don't have absolute authority and that some people's opinions may differ. Totally doesn't mean very. It means despite that you might think otherwise, I'm asserting that. And so there's a theory of mind in it. Now, of course, if somebody is trying to make a speech, if somebody is speaking in public, they should be told that they should try not to overdo the totalies and the likes. But to hear those things said on the subway, on the street, in the den, in the family room, I don't know why I'm talking like it's 1973, those things are indication of a sophistication in language. And I think we need to hear it that way because there's so many foreign languages that have little particles that do the same thing where somebody would look at that and think, how sophisticated. Boy, what a worldview those people must have. But then we hear it in our teenagers and 20-somethings and we think, oh, goodness, language is going to the dogs. It just isn't true.
Here's a linguistics call, I think, from Mark on the Lower East Side. Mark, you there?
Yeah, hi, Brian. Can you hear me?
Yeah, and this brings us back to Piketty and his book about capital in the 21st century.
Yes. If I
which we started the show with today. Go ahead.
Yeah. So if I understand the Piketty equation, it's R is greater than G. So would that, in a sly way, mean that it would be known as the Piketty split?
The lickety split. You're making
making a pun Piketty, on lickety split.
Say it again.
I guess Piketty split.
Would it be known as the Piketty split?
The Piketty split. R is greater than G.
I assume that it would be, and that is quite witty. Where are we supposed to go from there?
I don't think we can go anywhere from there other than say people who know Piketty and what R is greater than G, returns greater than growth means will maybe find that funny. Janet and Darianne cannot drop the butterfly analogy yet. Okay. Hi, Janet.
Brian, I'm sorry to return to it, but I am amazed that somebody who is apparently a linguistics professor has never wondered about the origin of such a strange word. It originally was flutterby, and flutterby is quite a mouthful. So, as has happened with so many other words in English, the letters were transposed and it became butterfly. It's much easier to say.
Is it really that much? That's interesting. Maybe it's true, but of course, flutterby is a perfect description of what a whatever you want to call it does.
Mm-hmm. And here's the point of it. The way that the word originated is an interesting factoid, but my point was that in the language that we have in our heads, it is butterfly. Nobody has access to what originally happened. And so my point was, do we think of it as a fly with butter? And we don't. We just immediately think of what it is, which shows that what the words mean in isolation is not always as connected with what we're actually thinking as we often suppose, and therefore language and thought is a very hazy issue.
Would flutterby be an onomatopoeia because the word sounds something like the thing it's described?
Well, I imagine also it was because that's what they do. But then it's rather natural. I'm not sure if it's hard to pronounce, but you see the thing flying, and it's kind of nice to think that there might be a buttery fly, and there you go. A lot of those things are as much chance as whether or not a snowflake is going to be shaped one way or another. But it's not a matter of how people are thinking.
Which is the point of your book. Now, you pushed back recently against the editor of Gawker, who wants his writer's language to be more grown up. He thinks they use too much internet slang, like OMG, WTF, plus one, things like that, and therefore leave some readers who don't text or tweet a lot confused. Bad idea?
Well, I just think that the editor there had a notion that certain ways of expressing oneself are, in some ineffable way, teenaged or gum-popping or tacky. And the problem is that as time goes by, things that once were thought of as that end up being quite normal. And so we have to be very careful when we say that such and such an expression, such as, you know, derp, is immature. Because as time goes by, words have a way of spreading. For example, if there was a time when people referred to a flutterby, some child said butterfly, it started getting picked up. These things happen gradually. Pretty soon nobody remembers flutterby. So in the same way, we'll hear something like lol or OMG, and we'll think, well, that's associated with something. But goodness, time passes. And so, for example, the word ASS and the way we use it now so often with an adjective such as a big pot or something like somebody had lame breath or something like that, that has just jumped around. Who would have thought in 1970 we would use that word so much? So you never know what's going to happen in language.
And who would consider LOL even as marginal at this point, right?
Right. Here we go.
I was surprised on the show recently when co-founder of Twitter, Biz Stone, was here, and he said,
people have started to, you know, condense their words and their language. I'm not a fan of it. I use full sentences. I don't abbreviate. I don't use emoticons. I'm
really
sort of
you?
An old school guy.
You?
Yeah.
Should we be surprised by that?
I don't know. I started out as an artist. I've written 3 books. I do a lot of writing in my spare time. I think email should start out with hello, person's name, comma, you know, something. They should be short, but they should be, you know, addressed properly.
So there you go. The co-founder of Twitter doesn't like Twitter speak.
Well, the co-founder of Twitter is indicating a fundamental difference between written language and speech. And in any society, there's a difference between a certain formal layer, which tends to be more elaborated, even if there isn't writing itself, and then the casual layer. And I think we can revel in both varieties of language without thinking that developments in one necessarily have to affect the other.
Can you do, in 20 seconds, which remain, your case recently for the complete removal of the comma from written English?
I never said that. For one thing, I didn't even write the piece. And what I was just saying one day, practically while I was eating lunch, was that a lot of the ways that we use a comma are technically not necessary. And the person who wrote the article, Matt Malady, wrote the whole thing without any commas. That's all I said. We still have to use them because we live in a society just like we have to wear pants.
Plenty of commas, I noticed, in the new book, The Language Hoax, Why the World Looks the Same in Any Language, by Columbia University linguist, Time Magazine and New Republic contributor, John McWhorter. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian. Much fun.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.